Excavating the Keys to History.
I think of it as they're looking for unfiltered history. They're looking for something that we don't know. The history books, people could write anything in those history books. What archaeologists want is ground proof. They want something that they can get their hands on, that they can prove was real.
That's Marilyn Johnson. We talk with her about her delightful and informative book, Lives in Ruins, Archaeologists and the Seductive Lure of Human Rubble. Then a brilliant satire of academia, entirely by means of letters of recommendation.
In terms of the academic novel, that was really an outgrowth of the fact that I wanted to write something in the form of LORs, as Professor Fitger terms them, letters of recommendation. He had to be an academic because those are the sorts of letters that I write myself. I know how dull they can be. I know how formulaic they can be. And I thought, J. Fitger will just bust that form wide open.
That's Julie Schumacher. Her new novel is Dear Committee Members. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. Thanks for joining us this hour. I'm your host, Francesca Riana. Archaeology is one of those romantic endeavors that few of us would have the gumption to pursue. I don't mean we don't have the stuff to swashbuckle like Indiana Jones, although that's probably true. It's the massive patience, the willingness to endure heat and cold, and the sheer perseverance to sift through tons of dust or mud to bring hidden treasures of the past to light. And all that for peanuts in pay, if you can even find a job doing it. But luckily for the rest of us, some people are eager to brave all obstacles so they can wrest the truth about the past from the bowels of the earth. My guest, Marilyn Johnson, tells the stories of these unsung heroes of archaeology in her new book, Lives in Ruins. The discoveries of these hardy scientists illuminate our human origins, reveal ancient recipes for alcoholic brews, solve crimes, and honor fallen soldiers of our revolution, to mention just a few of the stories in the book. For Lives in Ruins, Johnson got down and dirty with her subjects, going on digs in the Mediterranean and Caribbean. One comes away from this romp through the ruins with a real appreciation for those who make their living in them. Marilyn Johnson likes to write about the lesser-known corners of the job world. She's written a book about obituary writers, a bestseller called The Deadbeat, and another about librarians. This book is overdue. Well, Marilyn Johnson, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thank you.
This was just a terrific read. Lives in Ruins, Archaeologists and the Seductive Lure of Human Rubble. You've written about librarians before, and you've written about obituary writers, who, by the way, are some of my favorite writers as well. But why archaeologists?
Well, I think I was ready to go outdoors, first of all. I was ready for something of an adventure because I had written two books about very much indoor professions. But I also thought archaeologists were kind of in the same business as obituary writers and librarians. They were collecting bits of our cultural memory and trying to connect us with our past.
That's so true. But doing archaeology, of course, is a very different thing. As you say, you wanted to get outdoors. You went outdoors in pretty grueling circumstances.
All of these professions are not high-paying professions. This is not where you go to make a lot of money. This is where you go because you have a passion for the work. And archaeologists, I'm flabbergasted by what they have to put up with and what they have to deal with. You have to be really physically fit. You have to be sturdy, and your body has to take a lot of punishment. You have to be a scientist and control the circumstances and the ground on which you're making your stand. And you have to coordinate a crew of people. You have to get permission to do it. You have to check everything legally. And then you have to make sense of it. But they also seem to be having fun.
What makes them tick? Did you find something that was common among the archaeologists that was really what was driving their passion?
You know, I wish I could say that I found and identified the elixir and could bottle it, because all of us should care that much about the work that we do. But I don't really understand it. I got a bit of the fever myself, as I think you were able to tell from the book. When you are kneeling in the hot sun, you've got bugs crawling all over you, you've got mud, organic goo under your fingers. It is so intensely uncomfortable, and yet you don't feel any of it. You have this incredible suspense because you're digging in a place where no one has dug before. You are uncovering secrets. You don't know what you're going to find. I can't explain it. It's thrilling.
That's always a thing that's puzzled me, is, you know, to think about scratching in the dirt. You're not even sure you're going to find anything. It must be unbearably tedious, is what I've always thought. But you're saying, you know, it's the thrill of the hunt that it brings you, propels you forward.
I think of it as they're looking for unfiltered history. They're looking for something that we don't know. The history books, people could write anything in those history books. Some of them are written many decades, many hundreds of years after the events that they're describing. What archaeologists want is ground proof. They want something that they can get their hands on, that they can prove was real.
So, and they love Indiana Jones.
Indiana Jones is part of the vocabulary of archaeology. He has wormed his little way into the heart of archaeologists in a quite interesting way. I thought that they would not like him, but in fact, they give him a lot of credit for turning people on to archaeology. Of course, he does it all wrong. I mean, no archaeologist in his right mind would be doing some of the things that you see Harrison Ford do on screen. There's no such thing as crystal skulls. Are you kidding?
Yeah, that surprised me. I thought, I've seen them.
Aliens in one of those movies. How nuts is that?
Yes. Right, Indiana Jones. Now, he was based on, there was a real person.
Well, there are many contenders for that dubious honor.
But you make an important point here. Indiana Jones went about it, well, it was pretty swashbuckling, but he went about it in the wrong way, and that's because he took things out of, basically you say he was a looter. He took things out of context. So there's a more serious point here. Talk about the whole danger of people just picking things up off the ground. And I have to say this as somebody, I remember when I went to Chaco Canyon as a young woman, mm-hmm. and I saw some pottery shards, and yeah, I picked them up.
Oh, yeah. I think it's, you know, it's human nature to do that. And, you know, looting is a terrible problem. And when there are ruins that have anything of value in them, value because it's an old item, it's an artistic art item, or because it's made out of something valuable, like gold. People who are living in poverty, it's hard to judge them for ransacking these things. And in some cultures, it's not seen as a terrible thing to do. But even a casual person reaching down and picking up a bone or a coin from an archaeology site can mess up everything. How is this possible? Archaeologists look for things in context. And say a coin is in a place of ruins. There's no building there, but there's a coin there that if it were in place, intact, you could actually date that whole little patch of ground. You could figure out what was there based on some other clues and that coin, and figure out when it was there.
So what about all the artifacts that are in museums, you know, that have been taken away? I mean, there's been a huge amount of controversy, for example, around the Museum of the American Indian in New York.
Oh, yes. It's really, I think you have to distinguish. This book is very much about archaeologists who are practicing now. And they are practicing in an atmosphere that is not just trying to be sensitive to the people who might be connected to whatever those ruins are. They are actively trying to manage all of our cultural heritages. And so some of the most responsible people now are archaeologists in a profession that didn't always play by those rules. And I would say that some of the early archaeologists were not interested in taking intellectual content out of the dig. They were just trying to find the stuff, you know, the Elgin marbles, you know, that stuff ended up being, half of it being shipped to the United Kingdom. And this is like, you know, crazy, because if all of that stuff was in one place and somebody was paying attention, very careful attention to it, they could have learned so much more than they can by looking at it behind glass in the British Museum.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with Marilyn Johnson about her latest book, Lives in Ruins, Archaeologists and the Seductive Lure of Human Rubble. So now let's start at the beginning with paleoarchaeology. You talked to a guy named John Shea, who's a paleoarchaeologist. What does he study? What's his specialty?
John Shea's specialty is Ice Age lithics. Lithics are weapons, stone points. And so he is somebody who could take, you know, a little triangular-shaped piece of rock and tell you who made it, how it was made, how many times it was worked over, what it might have been used for. It's unbelievable. I mean, talk about something that seems boring and ends up being fascinating, his subject matter.
Yeah, and he takes a very, let's say, experiential approach.
Oh, yes. It's actually called experimental archaeology, and it makes a tremendous amount of sense. His whole take on archaeology is you can't understand things from the past that you might be digging up unless you live a life like the people whose remains are there. He really feels like if you are digging in the remains of a campfire, an old campfire, if you don't know how to make a campfire, if you don't know what the signs of an old campfire are, if you don't understand what happens to rock when it gets in the middle of fire, then you're the wrong person to be doing the digging. You have to really experience life as the people who you are studying.
And he almost had campus security at Harvard come after him because he was throwing a spear of some kind at a deer, although I have to say the deer was already dead.
Well, when I said that he could identify how a point had been used, whether it had been at the end of a spear or if it had been from an arrow, or whether somebody had had used it maybe to work on tanning hides, the reason he knows that is because he's used stone points for all of those things. He knows how it wears. So that kind of experimental archaeology makes utter sense in terms of learning what happens to material when you do certain things to it.
You know, I think a lot of people think, oh, you know, the Stone Age tools, they must have been really dull and heavy and really hard to use. You found yourself chipping off a knife of some kind, and it was razor sharp.
I don't mention this in the book, but one of the archaeologists that I interviewed had talked his surgeon into using an obsidian blade instead of the kind, you know, a steel blade. He said, oh, yes, you can get much, much sharper edges if you're using obsidian.
Yeah.
It's dangerous. I found it actually quite challenging to do. And in fact, I would have to say, and I'm sure you would agree with me, that I'm pretty hapless and that my experiences when people actually put those sharp tools in my hands were cautionary. I think you would, if you read this book and said, gee, I wonder what mistakes I might make on a dig for the first time, I will make all those mistakes for you so you can be really well-equipped when you go to do this yourself.
Now, one of your chapters, I was so intrigued by that actually went out and did a little bit of experiential archaeology of my own.
Really?
Well, it was your chapter on extreme beverages. You talked to Patrick McGovern, who will tell us who he is and what he discovered, and then I'll tell you what I did.
Well, he calls himself the Indiana Jones of extreme beverages. He's somebody who was a pottery expert out in the field, and at some point it occurred to him to scrape up the stuff that had accumulated at the bottom of some of these old pots and analyze it chemically. And he realized that he was scraping up some substances that were the remains of a meal that had been left in King Midas's tomb. And in other pots were the remains of something that looked like a combination of beer and wine. And he kept thinking about it, and he said, you know, I wonder what it was. You know, I wonder how they made it. And so he challenged a craft beer maker to help him reverse engineer it. And they came up with this honey mead-like beer. I mean, it's beer that's about three times as many calories as a regular beer. It's delicious. It's called Midas's Touch.
Yeah, and that was my experimental archaeology. I actually scored a bottle of Midas's Touch, as well as another one. This is from Dogfish Head Craft Brews.
Mm-hmm.
Midas's Touch was absolutely wonderful, and then I thought I would try the one. Let's see. It's Theobroma. It is chocolate with chocolate, honey, chilies, and annatto, and it is to die for.
Well, these are things that our ancestors, people who lived thousands of years ago, were drinking.
Right.
Some version of this. They were using, of course, ingredients that grew near them, but this is our best equivalent of what it was they were drinking. Isn't that cool?
Oh, it's fantastic. Yeah, and I can definitely recommend them. I got them at Whole Foods, actually.
You will get fat.
Yeah, that's true. Not something to be done on a daily basis by any means. So we are talking with Marilyn Johnson about her latest book, It's Lives in Ruins, Archaeologists and the Seductive Lure of Human Rubble. Before this, she wrote books about librarians and obituary writers. Now, you mentioned before that archaeologists make very little money. Jobs are also really scarce. What this is really saying is that our society seems to care very little about the past. And I wonder, what does it mean, do you think? What does it mean about us that we devalue the field of archaeology so that we support it so little?
Archaeologists don't make much. A lot of the jobs in archaeology these days are for contract archaeology. And these are people who work and they have to go in when there's a construction site and they're doing archaeology on an emergency basis, or they're doing it because they have to certify that the construction is not going to disturb an important part of our past. So there are jobs in archaeology. I don't know how good those jobs are or how reliable. It's a lot of part-time work the contract archaeologists that I talked to were doing. They were patching various jobs together. The pure information that we can gather from the past that I think all of us should be really actually kind of passionate about, it's hard. There's so many things that compete for our attention in life. One thing that I noticed was as we get older, we seem to care more about the past. We seem to value more what has been left from previous times. And so I don't think that we don't care at all about it, but I do think that we could care more. And archaeologists can help tell us how.
Right. And one of the examples where this plays out is actually in Fishkill, New York, where there is a supply depot from the Revolutionary War. A developer came in, wanted to develop the site and put, I don't know, was it a 7-Eleven on there or something like that? And ran smack into these laws that are protecting archaeological sites. I wonder if you could talk, first of all, tell us what's buried there, and then tell us what's been happening around that.
One of the archaeologists that I followed was a fascinating guy who, in the year 2007, discovered the remains of Revolutionary War soldiers on land that was slated for a strip mall. The strip mall has not been built, but the land is still for sale. It contains hundreds and hundreds of bodies of soldiers from the Revolutionary War. There are no gravestones. There are no markers. There is nothing to distinguish this 10-acre plot that is right on a very busy stretch of Route 9 across from a ghost mall. You know what a ghost mall is? Mm-hmm. Empty husks of buildings, a buckling parking lot. It's not really a very pretty sight. The owner he's a private landowner. He does not have to do anything. He does not have to sell the land. He doesn't have to preserve it. It's his to decide what to do. The state of New York and the town of Fishkill aren't going to let him build on top of those graves, but he would like to build right next to them. And there's nothing that says he can't. That's the weird thing. At any rate, the archaeologist and a whole bunch of other people who really care very passionately about the history of the Revolutionary War that's right under our noses here are trying to raise awareness. So they have these very respectful ceremonies, and they honor the veterans of our first war when it comes time for Veterans Day or for the laying of the wreath in December. And the owner is, you know, he's not a bad guy. He gives them permission to go onto the land and to lay the wreaths and say words of gratitude for these people who really suffered terribly during that war and during that winter, as an excavation of the barracks showed earlier in the century.
Mm. Now, there was another case, a wonderful story here. Here's a more uplifting story, at least one with a happier ending at this point, although the other may have a happy ending. And that is about the discovery of Captain Cook's ship, the Endeavour. Tell us that story and tell us about Kathy Abbas. Is that her
name?
Abbas, yeah.
Kathy Abbas is somebody, I was so fortunate to meet her. She's just, and I really shouldn't call these people characters, but they are such characters. Kathy, more so than almost anybody, she is passionate about underwater archaeology. She's passionate about the kinds of things that you can find buried in, for instance, her backyard in Newport Harbor. And one of the things she's identified is a fleet of British ships that were deliberately sunk there during, again, the Revolutionary War. And she has been trying to organize and fund a facility to excavate those ships and study them and preserve them. And in the course of this, she has discovered that one of those ships was the Endeavour Bark, which was the first ship to sail around the world with James Cook, the great explorer who people in the United Kingdom, in Australia, are mad for. We in the United States think of him as just another explorer, but he really was, he had quite an influence on everything. And this is a ship that has mysteriously disappeared from the record, and Kathy went over to England and collected the records that show that one of the ships that was deliberately sunk had been made out of the Endeavour bark.
Yeah, so it's just
how cool is that? So she's just signed an agreement this is breaking news, she just signed an agreement with the Australian government to partner in the identification and excavation.
Oh, that's fantastic. I mean, basically, it was the ship, it just got renamed, but it is the Endeavour. Wow,
yes.
That's just amazing. Another part of your book, Marilyn Johnson, in Lives of Ruins, you talk about the looting of the National Museum of Iraq, the looting of antiquities in Afghanistan during the Afghanistan war that's still ongoing, and now in Syria. You found out that the U.S. Department of Defense is actually quite committed to protecting antiquities. This, in spite of the fact that Donald Rumsfeld said, you know, stuff happens, basically, when the National Museum of Iraq was looted. But things have changed over at the DOD. Tell us what they're doing.
Well, that was a terrible chapter in our history when the casual destruction was not acknowledged and when our efforts to go in and help people in the ancient world, when we would do things like bulldoze an ancient cemetery to set up a position for the troops. These things were done either in ignorance, mainly I think in ignorance, and they presented a terrible problem for Americans and the American military. And what ended up happening in the wake of this horrible PR fiasco was that archaeologists and our military have been partnering to try to be sensitive to the ancient past of some of the places that we end up going. So what you have are a bunch of archaeologists in this book who are trying to be proactive. They're trying to get out front and help train even ordinary soldiers so they can recognize the signs of an ancient ruin. So if they see broken pottery on a patch of desert, they stop and assess it and notify somebody, a cultural affairs officer who's been trained and who can help them determine, yes, this is an ancient site and we're going to not go into it. We're going to put barricades around it. We're going to help protect it. Instead of destroying it, we're going to help protect it.
Yeah, they're even using a pack of playing cards, much as they did with, you know, Saddam Hussein and, you know, during the Iraq War, there was the playing
using
cards.
Using the playing cards as educational tools. So it has pictures of some of the great ruins of Afghanistan and Iraq on the other side, and it tells you about it. It tells you about, something of the cultural customs of the country. And these are things that archaeologists are doing. I would never have thought that that would be part of their job. One of the archaeologists in the book is helping train cadets in cultural sensitivity. It's kind of cool.
So after you finished this book, you went on a number of sites and did some digging around yourself. After all of this work, what most surprised you? What was kind of the aha moment of this journey for you?
What a good question. I think it was when I was at the Revolutionary War graveyard in Fishkill, which looks like an empty lot, and I was holding a little American flag, and I was listening to this archaeologist try to tell us what life was like for an ordinary soldier, and I just had this shiver of it was not about what was long ago dead and gone and are now pieces of bone. It was about real people. It was about people who had something to do with my life. And that connection, that thing that I think everybody is really deep down responding to, that archaeologists are connecting us with, is our ancestors, people who came before us, who would have had all the same kinds of fears and hopes and feelings and suffered the same way that we do. It made me feel part of the human continuum.
Well, that's lovely. And your book, Lives in Ruins, Marilyn Johnson, really drives that point home how important archaeology is to us and how we need to value it. I want to thank you so much for talking with us here on Writer's Voice.
Thank you. Thank you, Francesca. I enjoyed it.
Marilyn Johnson. Lives in Ruins was released by HarperCollins this week. Go to writersvoice.net to read an excerpt hot off the press. Next up, Julie Schumacher skewers the ivory tower. Stay tuned after the break. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Novels set in academia comprise their own corner of the literary landscape. Some are serious in mood, like Philip Roth's The Human Stain. Others are murder mysteries, like Dorothy Sayers' Gaudy Night. But a large number of campus novels are satires that skewer the characteristic foibles of Homo Academicus. My guest Julie Schumacher's new novel, Dear Committee Members, is in that latter category, but it casts a wider net to critique not just academics, but what's happening to academia. NPR reviewer Maureen Corrigan called the book a mordant minor masterpiece. The novel is entirely in the form of letters of recommendation, or LORs, written by English professor Jay Fitker. Vain and arrogant, he's not terribly likable, but oh, does he have a way with words and a bone to pick. He can't help but turn his LORs into rants about the desperate state of the humanities in contemporary academia, the hemorrhaging of students, the drought of funding, the disregard for teaching, and the erosion of culture. These are serious issues indeed, but Schumacher's book had me laughing while I was crying with its brilliant wit and rapier-like language. Like her protagonist in Dear Committee Members, Julie Schumacher is a professor of creative writing. She teaches at the University of Minnesota. She's also the author of the novel The Body is Water, a short story collection, and 5 books for younger readers. Well, Julie Schumacher, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thank you for having me.
I loved this book, and, you know, it's an unusual book, I think, to get such great reviews as it actually has, because it's in a very particular kind of genre, you know, academic fiction about academia. And it takes a mordant aim at the current state of academia. So it has a social as well as a psychological dimension. I'd like to ask you, why did you decide to kind of tackle this form, this genre, with this book?
In terms of the form of the book, number one, I set myself the task, I suppose, of writing a novel in the form of letters of recommendation. Being an academic myself for 15 to 20 years, I write a lot of letters of recommendation, and I just thought this would be a sort of playful, amusing exercise. If it didn't work out, I could pitch it and try something else, but it just seemed a good exercise for me to set to myself that I could give it a whirl. And in terms of the academic novel, that was really an outgrowth of the fact that I wanted to write something in the form of LORs, as Professor Fitker terms them, letters of recommendation. He had to be an academic because those are the sorts of letters that I write myself. I know how dull they can be. I know how formulaic they can be. And I thought, Jay Fitker will just bust that form wide open.
And he absolutely does. I mean, he is a voice of sardonic genius, and and the letters of recommendation are completely self-revealing, and there's not a whole lot of a plot, but they drive the plot, and it's just a wonderful turn on this this genre. I doubt that there's another book out there that has taken this epistolary form.
Probably not. I hope not. I don't know of one. And that was the other fun thing about working on the book. I realized very early in the first page or two of drafting the novel that if I could create something successful within the letter of recommendation form, I would have to make my character an egotist and a very inappropriate person. I needed him to talk about himself rather than simply to write about the people he's supposed to be recommending.
Now, tell us a little bit about Jason Fitger. Give us a sense of the character.
Well, he's a traditionalist. He is not enamored of technology the way many people in higher ed are now. So many people get very excited about the STEM fields, and even in K through 12 education, a computer in every desk, every child with an iPad. That is not the way Jay thinks. It's not really the way I think either. And he's a real defender of the arts and humanities, but he is a person who can't keep a lid on his thoughts. He is no diplomat. And rather than tactfully going about promoting the things that he cares very deeply about, arts and letters, his own students, his Master of Fine Arts program in creative writing, he turns into a real loudmouth and can be kind of a loose cannon.
But as a loudmouth and a loose cannon, I mean, he's not the most likable of characters, but you could really sense the way in which he is an alter ego for you in the way that he takes aim at what's going on in higher education today. I'd like to read a paragraph here. Here's Jason is writing to the chair of the English department, which has asked for nominations for the position of Director of Graduate Studies. And I think this paragraph kind of encapsulates some of the things, the problems, the devolution, one could almost say, of higher education. So he says, to the matter at hand, though English has traditionally been a largest department, you will find there are very few viable candidates capable of assuming the mantle of DGS, that is the Director of Graduate Studies. In fact, if I were a betting man, I'd wager that only 10% of the English instruction list will answer your call for nominations. Why? First, because more than a third of our faculty now consists of temporary adjunct instructors who creep into the building under cover of darkness to teach the graveyard shifts of freshman comp. They're not eligible to vote or to serve. Second, because the remaining two-thirds of the faculty, bearing the scars of disenfranchisement and long-term abuse, are busy tending to personal grudges like scraps of carrion on which they gnaw in the gloom of their offices. Long story short, your options aren't pretty. So, talk about the ugly options. And I have to tell you, I was an adjunct professor for 4 years, and it was, you know, really the bottom of the barrel in terms of employment. Mm-hmm. I think I made way less than minimum wage if you counted up my hours.
Yeah, I have been an adjunct also. I'm now very fortunately a tenured faculty member, but the novel gave me a chance to point out some of what I consider to be a crisis in higher education. I certainly didn't start out to write any sort of manifesto about the problems in higher ed, but as the book went on, I started to realize that the things that Jay would be railing about are things that I care deeply about, including the lack of tenure-track hiring, particularly in the arts and humanities, as opposed to the hiring of adjunct, very underpaid faculty who don't receive benefits, the difficulty of the high cost of education for undergraduates who are going into debt and wondering, will I ever recoup this money with any sort of salary, or will I be saddled with debt into my 60s when I need to retire? The inequity within universities in terms of field, the emphasis on, again, these STEM fields, science, technology, engineering, math, at the expense often of the French department, classics, art, art history, things that to me are very important and matter very deeply, but are pushed by the wayside in favor of giving everybody a computer.
And for those of our listeners, and I'm doing this interview at the University of Massachusetts, which, you know, has its privileged departments and it's not so privileged. I mean, we can contrast business to history. You know, the spanking new and no longer new, but the beautiful building of the School of Business contrasted to the, I mean, it's right out of the pages of your novel of, you know, the languages, the Germanic languages department, which had, you know, mold and it was dingy and hadn't been updated since the 1950s. So for those of our listeners here and elsewhere who are facing the situation, why are the humanities so important? What do you feel is the impact of the de-emphasis of the humanities?
Well, I think it's a bit short-sighted to de-emphasize the humanities because, yes, we do want to educate people who can find gainful employment after they graduate. But I think some sorts of degrees, business, tech degrees, accounting, etc., a person may graduate with that sort of education and then find that 3 years post-degree, that field has changed in a way that makes them now ill-adapted to find employment in it. So to me, a humanities education is, this is the cliche, certainly not my idea, a way of producing a very broadly educated person, a person who can think, critique, analyze, sift, reason. There's a moment in the novel where Professor Fitger makes a big stand about the humanities, saying that the person with the tech degree is like a plumber clutching a single shining box of tools, whereas the person who graduates in the liberal arts or humanities is an adaptable creature. And I believe that as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Now, in these letters of recommendation, I mean, you're also, your targets are wider than just this, you know, de-emphasis of the humanities and this favoritism towards STEM. It gives you an opportunity to see what's going on with so many graduates of higher education who can't find a job, who are asking for letters of recommendation for practically flipping burgers. Talk a little bit about that and some of how you bring that out in this novel.
Well, there are moments when Jay Fitger ends up recommending former students for a paintball emporium, a place called Catfish Catering, and while he's recommending them, he's also slamming the people who intend to hire them. You know, this is a job I'm recommending my student to you, but this job isn't good enough for my student. So, again, he's advocating for the students, but he's so frustrated that he's unable to do so in any sort of effective way. I personally haven't written letters to places as strangely specific as the ones that Professor Fitger writes to, but I enjoyed inventing those in the novel.
And satire as a form, this is something, have you taken this up before also, and how was it to work with this? Is this something that comes naturally to you? I know you've written several novels, but most of them have not been in this satiric vein.
No, this is a bit of a departure for me. I wrote 5 novels for younger readers, one of them about a mother-daughter book club to which none of the people who are in the book club want to belong. They're forced to be in it. And so I have written things that are a bit snide and things that are bookish about books. But this was the first written about academia in this way and the first satire, as you say. And it was a departure. It was great fun. Often writing for me is an initial burst of fun followed by lots of frustration and hard work, as it is for almost anybody who works hard on a project. But this one was kind of freakishly enjoyable, start to finish. I had fun every moment of writing this book.
And I can imagine why, because it well, say more. Say why it was so much fun. What do you think made this so far unique for you?
Well, I think there was a lot of catharsis involved. I was able to channel some of my own frustrations and anxieties through Jay Fitker. I think there's a tiny version of Professor Fitker that must live inside me. I'm relatively a cheerful person on the outside, but every now and then, as I think anybody would feel within a particular work environment, the frustration mounts up and you think, boy, would I like to just fire off a letter. And of course you don't, because it's not appropriate. But Jay was able to say a lot of things I personally would never say, because I want to have a modicum job of respect in the workplace.
I was going to say a job as well.
Yes, that too.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with Julie Schumacher about her latest novel, Dear Committee Members. And you also take aim at the publishing industry, because we should say that Jason Fitker had an early, a debut novel of some real success, which actually you also had. You're mm-hmm. had some good success, but you've also had success with other work, and certainly with this one. But he rails against the publishing industry as well. So talk a little bit about that and how the book addresses those issues.
Well, he had an initial novel that was promoted in part by his advisor at a place called The Seminar. And his initial novel was apparently a tell-all about his classmates, his professor, and it was a salacious sort of read. It was snapped up. Everybody loved it. And then when he tried to write the second and the third novels, they flagged. They were not well received. And he's not sure if this is his fault or if he should be able to blame it on someone else, namely his agent, his publisher, his editor. I think when you read the book carefully, you see that it's probably not his editor that's to blame. It's probably Jay Fitker who is to blame. But he is railing against lots of different people. He does complain about the publishing industry wanting sensational material, things about werewolves. He complains about a former student of his who has sold a six-figure deal, a novel about a woman who turns into a cheetah and swallows her younger brother. These things drive him wild. But I think it's also fairly clear that his own work is probably not as good as he imagines it to be.
Right. And also, he's not exactly the world's greatest husband.
No, he is an ex-husband. And one of the strands in the novel that allowed me to tie it together was the fact that Jay Fitker has an ex-wife who is an admissions officer in the law school on his campus. So he writes several letters of recommendation to her. He has an ex-girlfriend who is in the student fellowship financial aid office. He writes to her on occasion. So he is able to portray relationships and his own romantic and literary history via some of these letters.
And not a very successful history at that.
No, he's not in a good moment of his life, poor Jay. And it's interesting. I've gotten a whole bunch of emails from professors I don't know, from various parts of the country, saying, here I am also at midlife thinking the best things are behind me, and I'm a bit of a dinosaur here at my university. The future approaching is not one that I look at with a whole lot of happiness, and Jay Fitker has captured that feeling for me. Some people in the humanities, and actually someone in dentistry, someone who teaches dentistry and someone who teaches statistics. So even people who are not necessarily in the arts and humanities have told me that they identify a bit with poor Professor Fitker.
Well, on that note, I'd love to read you. I went to the Amazon page for the book, and I just read through a couple of comments, and one really leaped out to me because you can see how your book has struck a chord. So the guy says, I checked out Amazon and here's a comment. I adore this book. There, I said it. I'm an assistant dean at a small college that caters to the technology departments. I am not in one of those departments. I am in general education where I teach the lesser desired English and humanities. So much of this rang true for me. In fact, I brought it to work and read aloud sections to our faculty and the dean, both of whom adored it and pre-ordered their own copies.
I haven't seen that. I love that.
Originally, I thought I was the only one who had these kinds of dark thoughts and ideas, but this book was a great solace to me. That must be very gratifying.
It is. It's terrific to hear that. I think it did. I think the book was very well timed. I think there are frustrations that people feel within academia that at this particular moment in time that Jay seems to tap into. And yes, I'm delighted about that.
You know, one of my pet peeves, college that I taught at, you know, and I like to joke then that, you know, kind of the only perk of my position was that I got to call myself professor. Even though I was just adjunct faculty, but everybody called me professor. You know, one of my pet peeves was how much money is going into things like climbing walls and not going into faculty. So I wonder
athletic programs. Yep.
Yeah. Could you comment a bit on that and how have you seen that impact where you teach?
Well, it was eye-opening to me to be at a university and to realize that there is a competition for resources between departments. Students compete against each other to attract students, to attract tuition dollars, to attract potential donors. That hadn't really occurred to me before I'd been in higher ed for a few years. I thought the point would be that the entire university would think together, how do we best educate our students in a well-rounded way? Yes, let's offer them a yoga class and sure, they can have a basketball team, but what do they really need to learn here? And let's start with that premise. And I have been a bit boggled by the competition among units as a principal.
Mm-hmm. And how have you seen it also, affect the quality of teaching, not necessarily of teachers, but of teaching?
Well, I don't know of faculty who are not doing their best, whether they are adjunct faculty, in which case they're working extremely hard, often at multiple institutions, or the tenured faculty who worked extremely hard to get where they are today. But I think there are just so many changes happening so quickly in higher ed, both in terms of technology, in terms of cost and resources, online learning versus in the classroom, learning adjunct versus full-time faculty. I don't know where we're going, but everything is changing very quickly.
I would imagine it's a very confusing environment, and not just for traditionalists like Jay Fitker.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm in my own little unit in creative writing and English, so I have my own particular, you know, vantage point on the situation. And within our own program at Minnesota, we have held on very hard to the principle that anybody admitted to our graduate program is admitted with funding. I don't want to teach at a program where people go into debt to study poetry. That makes no sense to me. Going into debt for medicine, I suppose, makes sense if you can earn the money back as a physician later on. But, you know, I think each unit needs to look at itself and figure out, again, how do we best educate and serve the students? That has to be the primary and the very most important criteria.
Yeah, well, that is unusual. You know, I've certainly seen, when I first went to graduate school back in the 70s, there was full fellowships. Years later, when I went back for an education degree, there was some help, and the loans were low. And then, when I thought I might go back again, now to history, there was absolutely no help at all. It was loans at high rates. Mm-hmm. Is that the direction
I know.
That
well, my own kids are 23 and 26, and they have plenty of friends who are, you know, $50,000, $60,000, $70,000, $80,000 in debt in their early 20s working at a restaurant. And it's a terrible situation. We have to be able to figure out something to do about it.
Mm. So, Julie Schumacher, are you working on another novel at this time?
I'm working on a collection of short stories, and I am thinking, I haven't decided whether I've quite let go of Jay Fitger yet. He is, he spoke to me so clearly after I thought about the concept for this book, and I don't know whether I'm done with him yet or not. I'll see.
If you took him up again, would it be in the same epistolary format?
I don't know. I just know that typically when I'm finished a book, I am tired of those characters. I want to set them aside and move on to somebody else. But Jay is, even though he is a bitter, curmudgeonly sort of person, he is very charming to me. He's endearing to me. I have a lot of affection for poor Jay.
And to this reader, likewise. Oh, I wanted to ask you one other thing, which was throughout the novel, dear committee members, he is trying to get help for a graduate student. He's trying to get somebody to publish the novel of a graduate student of his, Darren Brawls,
yes,
who has done a novel called Accountant in a Bordello.
Yes, it's probably not the best of novels in process. But he's he's determined to champion Darren Brawls' novel because Darren is presumably one of the last graduate students he has. He feels that if Darren succeeds, that will be good for his program and for future students. So he's determined to champion this work. On the other hand, Accountant in a Bordello doesn't sound like a terrific novel, and I think that becomes pretty clear to the reader that Jay is probably betting on the wrong horse.
Right. He calls it a shattering reinterpretation of Herman Melville's Bartleby the Scrivener, set at one of the biggest legal whorehouses in the state of Nevada. Now, Bartleby the Scrivener, of course, was the guy who said, I refuse.
I prefer not to.
Oh, that's right. I prefer not to. That is it. So is there something you're telling us? Is this a metaphor of some kind?
Mainly, I remembered reading Bartleby when I was an undergrad, and I thought, this is one dull novel. That was my main reaction to it, and I still don't really like Bartleby the Scrivener very much, and I thought it would be amusing to have Darren Brawls reprising a slim little quirky novella by writing a wildly inflated 500-page novel called Accountant in a Bordello. So it started with my thought that Bartleby isn't not a very interesting book, at least to me.
Right. But I think that Jay Fitger also would say that he prefers not to all kinds of things.
That's probably true.
Well, Julie Schumacher, it's been delightful to talk with you, and it was a delightful read, dear committee members. I thank you so much for talking with us here on Writer's Voice.
Thanks for having me.
That was Julie Schumacher. You can read an excerpt from her novel, Dear Committee Members, by going to writersvoice.net. Julie Schumacher. You can enjoy an excerpt from Dear Committee Members by going to our awesome newly designed website, writersvoice.net. Thanks and kudos to our terrific web designer and strategist, Bill Way. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net to listen to or download past shows, plus find out more about our guests or read book excerpts. You can also sign up to get the show delivered straight to your inbox or subscribe to the podcast and the newsletter. And follow us on Twitter at Writer's Voice, all one word. Then check out my blog, Francesca Rhiannon at blogspot.com. You can find lots of cool stuff there. The Writer's Voice webmaster is Bill Way. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.